No She Didn't is a new podcast produced by a husband and wife team. They focus on the forensic psychology aspect of true crime and criminal investigations. Each week a new podcast will be released on Fridays discussing a true crime case and how forensic psychology played a role in the investigation.
Hey friends, it's Alicia
and Jamie
from the No She Didn't podcast. Today we want to focus on a serial killer that asked for help, but an accidentally dropped phone call left him feeling ignored and dismissed.
Gary Lee Sampson went on to murder three men and the attempted murder of another man.
Gary Lee Sampson had known nothing but a life of crime since his youth. He had actually been in and out of juvenile detention centers, and as an adult, he had been in and out of jail repeatedly. He had had a very troubled history that ultimately progressed from robbing banks to murder.
Gary Sampson was born to Elbert Herc Sampson and Charlotte Sampson.
What kind of nickname is that?
I'm going to assume that's short for Hercules. He's probably a tough guy.
Oh, goodness.
So, Elbert and Charlotte also had another son named Wayne. Elbert was a firefighter, an ice cream truck driver, and a salesman. That's an odd collection of jobs.
Yes, it is.
Gary later tells that his father often called him retarded during his childhood and that he physically abused him.
Oh, that's heartbreaking to hear that.
His brother Wayne would later confirm during Gary's trial that Gary was abused and mistreated. Childhood friends would say that Gary just never fit in and that he was always the odd person out in the group.
His friends and family would say that Gary did fall at the age of 4, and as a result from the fall, he sustained a traumatic brain injury. Now, we know that this is important from a forensic psychology aspect because brain injuries can have significant effects on individual behavior. It can impact your impulse control, as well as your self-awareness, your emotions, and your urges. It can also lead to problems like anger, impulsive actions, self-centeredness, impaired awareness, and even violence. Now, later in his adult life, Gary would be diagnosed with bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, and antisocial disorder, formerly referred to as psychopathy.
As a child, Gary Sampson also faced some developmental setbacks such as dyslexia. Now, dyslexia is a learning disorder that involves difficulty reading. Individuals that suffer from dyslexia have trouble identifying speech sounds and learning how they relate to letters and words.
Now, Jamie, dyslexia, that is the developmental disorder where sometimes people read their numbers and letters backwards. Is that right?
Yeah, and not necessarily backwards. They just move all around.
Gotcha. Okay.
Now, another aspect of dyslexia is that it affects areas of the brain that process language. Sadly, Gary did not fall into the requirements he needed to receive extra help in school with the dyslexia because of his intelligence level, though he did excel in areas of art and music. So, sadly, in the 1960s, you had to fall into a certain category to be able to participate in special education or special needs classes.
During his later trial, Gary would tell that he got kicked out of the seventh grade for pulling a switchblade knife on his teacher. Gary would actually go ahead and wind up dropping out of high school in the ninth grade. Gary had a very lengthy criminal record that would actually begin at the age of 15, and we want to talk you through some of the events that occurred.
So, Gary was arrested on a breaking and entering charge in Abington, Massachusetts, when he was just 15 years old. Now, 17-year-old Gary in 1976 was charged with trying to steal gasoline as well as other motor vehicle offenses. This same year, he also married his 17-year-old girlfriend that was pregnant with his child at the time. This would be the first of his three children.
Wow, he's already been in trouble quite a bit at that age, hasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he's not even, you know, 18 yet.
Gotcha. 19, our research tells us that he was actually acquitted of a charge that he had raped a 15-year-old girl in Weymouth, Massachusetts. Then, at the age of 20, he was charged with trespassing and drug possession in Abington, Massachusetts. 21, he was in charge with armed robbery, stealing a car in Abington. He actually served time in the Plymouth County Jail, In 1981, though, he briefly escaped from the jail by sawing through a gate. So he was very tricky, wasn't he?
That sounds like. So at 23 years old in 1982, he received a 3-year suspended sentence for breaking into a gas station in Tamworth, New Hampshire. Now, later that same year, he was convicted of violating his probation. At 25 years old in 1984, he pled guilty to burglarizing a home in Tamworth, New Hampshire, sentenced to up to 7 years, and again he escaped from prison that same year and was sentenced to an additional 1 to 3 years.
So he's already been in trouble for robberies, theft, breaking and entering, stealing, gasoline from a gas station.
Yeah, it sounds like as he was a teenager, he got in a whole lot of trouble for messing around with cars and stealing gas. And then as he got a little older, it kind of bumped up to like actual trespassing and breaking and entering.
Gotcha. And so then the breaking out of jail and prison and things like that, that just showed that he was tricky.
He was pretty crappy.
He was a planner. All right. So at 28, he was convicted of a parole violation and he was sentenced to nearly 4 years. So in 1995, after he'd been released from jail for a theft charge, he actually wound up moving on to Tamworth, New Hampshire, where he would meet Karen Alexander. Karen would actually become one of his later wives. So when he was 37, as you can tell, he's really, really increasing in violence. His crimes are actually getting worse as they go, which we find to be very relevant from the psychology standpoint. For this leads up to what he ultimately winds up doing. So, at 37, he was fined $60 for speeding in New Hampshire. He married, in June of 97, he did marry Karen Alexander while she was currently pregnant with their child. So,
all right. So then at 38 years old, it's now 1997, he's fined $500 for possession of marijuana. Now, later that same year, he pled guilty to assault and making threats to a woman in New Hampshire and served about 5 months. And then later in 1997, he was fined $100 for transporting alcohol.
Gotcha. So then my research tells me that at 39, he was convicted of threatening another woman in New Hampshire. He was sentenced to a year in jail with 6 months deferred and 2 years probation. So it looks like he kind of gets the easy end of his sentences. Like yeah. They forgive him and say, okay, well, let's try not to do that again.
Yeah, I guess because he was just threatening and so far hadn't done any actual physical harm that we know of, that they just kind of smacked him on the wrist and said, hey, you got 6 months, deferred 2 years, quit messing around.
Gotcha. Well, during his time in jail this time, he met Amanda Newcomb. Amanda's grandfather actually posted Gary's bail, and shortly thereafter, Gary and Amanda were married. So this marriage lasted about 1 month. He had been arrested for theft again from an antique store and was placed on bond. He skipped out on the bond, and during this time, he decided to change his identity to Gary Johnson, a construction worker. So he tried to put on that disguise. Yeah. So
at 40 years old in 1999, he's accused of violating probation by not showing up for an arraignment on burglary charges in New Hampshire. Later in 99, New Jersey police charged him with a probation violation. And police said he was using several aliases, including women's names.
Gotcha. Well, Gary would then move to North Carolina, where he began a relationship with a man. He had strictly had female relationships before this, but he met a man named Ricky Carter. Ricky was a transvestite, and he would later describe Gary as being angry with the world and having an explosive temper. And soon this relationship failed. When Carter kicked him out of their apartment, Gary actually met another woman, and her name was Karen Anderson. Now, Karen would later tell that Gary tried to force her to help him in the upcoming bank robbery scheme, but she refused. So, as we alluded, we're going to tell you about bank robberies.
So, he's really progressed here now. He's 41 years old, the year's 2001, and he is accused of 5 bank robberies while in disguise as a woman in North Carolina. He's really moving around. He's already made it to North Carolina. Mm-hmm. So he had learned how to dress as a female and how to apply makeup that would alter his appearance drastically. According to the local sheriff that was investigating the robberies, Gary was known to hang out with crossdressers and transvestites, and through these friendships, he had learned how to alter his appearance.
Gotcha.
Now, this is fascinating from a psychological perspective, because he knew what he was doing, and he was careful in his planning on how to rob the banks. He didn't want to be identified, and it appears he didn't even want to be noticed as a man. He tried to look like a woman.
Well, I mean, if you are in a video robbing a bank, and you are have the appearance of a woman, of course, they're going to look for a woman.
A woman.
So, while he was on the run for the bank robberies, Gary did decide to turn himself in. So, on July the 23rd of 2001, Gary decides to call the FBI in Boston, that office there in Boston, and he calls from a payphone in Abington, Massachusetts. He wants to surrender for the bank robberies in North Carolina. He's had some type of remorse happen, and he wants to turn himself in. He's tired of life on the run. So, he places the phone call, and an FBI clerk accidentally disconnects the call, and Gary waits, but no one shows up to arrest him. Yes, you heard me correctly earlier. An FBI clerk disconnected the call on accident, and there was no follow-up. So after no one comes for him, Gary decides that he wants to kill the sheriff in his hometown that had been talking about him being a transvestite himself, that he was hanging out with transvestites, that he was living some type of gay life. This embarrassed him, so he just decided, I'm going to go kill the sheriff. So he actually heads for Abington, Massachusetts. He goes there, but when he can't find the sheriff, he takes off on foot and starts hitchhiking. So he makes sure that he's dressed in conservative manner so that people won't be afraid to pick him up. Because at that time, you know, probably if you saw a guy in nice clothing, you would think, oh, they're just needing a ride somewhere, or their car broke down or something.
Right, yeah.
So, unfortunately, Philip McCloskey does pick him up, and unfortunately, Gary's murder spree begins there.
So, on July the 24th of 2001, Philip McCloskey had just been to visit a friend and had picked up some flowers in Weymouth, Massachusetts, when he decided to pick up Gary Sampson. Now, Sampson eventually used a knife to hijack McCloskey's car, and authorities said that Sampson drove McCloskey to Marshfield before stabbing him to death. His body was found with 24 stab wounds in a wooded area roughly 200 feet away from his abandoned Mazda minivan off Old Main Street in Marshfield. Now, his body was found late in the morning on Thursday, July 26th, and there was no sign of a struggle, and according to then Plymouth County Assistant District Attorney, items were missing from McCloskey's body. His wallet, a large gold ring with a wide band and dark gemstone, a silver round-faced watch, cell phone, and a set of car keys, and an undisclosed amount of money. McCloskey was a retired pipe fitter, and he had worked for more than 40 years as a serviceman for the Boston Gas Company in order to support his wife and six children. Now, when asked about the murder during his trial, Sampson stated that after stabbing him multiple times, Sampson said, I slit his throat. Why? I don't know.
So he didn't just stab him, he also slit his throat. And has no reason why he did such a violent act. So he's clearly is losing control. He's out. He's in a spiral.
Yeah.
So
he's escalating and he can't stop himself.
Gotcha. Well, it's enough to stab someone, and I know they will discuss this later in the trial. You know, it's enough that he stabbed the person, but, you know, one of those stab wounds could have immediately killed the man, but then he decided to just go ahead and slit his throat, you know, just to get to the gory side of it, I guess, you know. So afterward, Gary was said to have wandered the South Shore for several days, and he did encounter a number of people who later on testified at the trial about their interactions with him. So, unfortunately, on July the 27th, a really sweet 19-year-old kid named Jonathan Rizzo picked him up. Jonathan was from Kingston, Massachusetts. He actually ran into Gary at the Plymouth waterfront after leaving work at 9 p.m. So he gives Gary a ride. So Gary, let me tell you a little bit about Jonathan, if you don't mind. So Jonathan was actually referred to by his family and friends as Rizzo. He was actually home for the summer. He would have been a sophomore in the fall at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. So we know that he was last seen at 9 p.m. On a Friday, leaving the Weather Vane Seafood Restaurant on the Plymouth waterfront, where he'd been working as a waiter since May. He was actually headed to his parents' home to have pizza with friends. So he picked up Gary. Gary actually threatened him that he was going to steal his car. He told Rizzo that if he would just take him somewhere, that he would drop him off out in the woods, that he would not kill him. So Jonathan thought that if he did what this man said, that he's not going to kill him. So we do later on find out that he sprayed Rizzo with bug repellent to distract him and to make him think that he wasn't going to kill him. But then he decided to take Jonathan's clothing off and actually use one of his socks to stuff it in his mouth and actually wound up stabbing him 15 times. So Gary had actually killed Rizzo with the same razor-sharp Remington knife that he had used 3 days earlier to stab McCloskey 24 times, and you know, after tying him up there. So they didn't find Rizzo's body immediately. It was a few days later that they actually found him.
So on July the 31st, Rizzo's body is found tied to a tree behind the Abington Ale House. Now, during the trial, Rizzo's mother, Mary, told jurors of the car rides that they had shared and the songs they sang, and she also recounted her heartbreak when she found out that her son had been tied to a tree and stabbed. She wanted to see his body, but was not allowed, so she reached into a closet and gave a blanket to an investigator, asking him to cover up her son's body. I just wanted him covered up, but more than anything, I wanted my hands on this blanket and my love to be covering him, she told jurors. During Sampson's trial, he would say, I sprayed him with the off insect repellent to make him think I wasn't going to kill him. But he stuffed Rizzo's, like you said earlier, stuffed his own socks in his mouth to keep him from calling out and being able to cry for help, and he stabbed him to death.
I can't imagine that mother's pain, you know, to know that her child was tied to a tree, his body was left there uncovered. You know, she wanted desperately to be there to hold her child and wasn't able to. But she had the wherewithal in her mind to grab a blanket, to squeeze it, probably to tell, you know, the blanket to keep her son warm, you know, or to wrap her love around him, you know, at that time. And I can't imagine the devastation of losing a child in that manner.
I don't even want to try to think about it.
Yeah. So Sampson then drove Rizzo's car to a lakeside resort community in New Hampshire, and he broke into what looked like an empty house. But he was surprised when a gentleman by the name of Robert Eli Whitney surprised him. Mr. Whitney was a neighbor who was caring for the house. So he's lost his mind at this point. You know, he's just murdering people left and right.
He's kind of going around at random.
Yeah, there was a note that I read in the file that said that during Sampson's trial, they find a supervisor that actually worked at the Milesh Standish State Forest. Actually had signed an incident report shortly after Sampson encountered the park rangers there, and that was between the murders of Mr. McCloskey and Mr. Rizzo, and he actually described Sampson as having a psych disorder. So he clearly, other people knew when they encountered him that something was wrong.
Yeah, something's wrong with this guy.
Yeah.
He's not acting right, not talking right.
Exactly. So on July the 28th, Gary heads for New Hampshire, where his family had once lived, and this is where he encounters Mr. Whitney.
Okay, so on July the 30th, Robert Whitney, he's 58 years old. He's a former city councilor in Concord, New Hampshire, and he's found strangled in a cottage on Lake Winnipesaukee in Meredith, New Hampshire. Now, Rizzo's car is parked outside, And as friends and family organized a massive search, still looking for Rizzo, Sampson broke into a vacation lake house that was owned by a friend of Robert Whitney's who had recently died. Now, Mr. Whitney had agreed to help his friend's widow renovate the home into a full-time residence and had arrived there the next morning to mow the lawn. So Gary Sampson had actually spent the night in that lake house and was startled by Mr. Whitney when he had come over that morning to mow. So after a struggle, Sampson tied Mr. Whitney to a chair and strangled him to death. Now, during his trial, Gary Sampson would say he struggled, he was pretty strong, and the man died slow. After murdering Mr. Whitney, he cooked breakfast while the man was dead in the bathroom.
So absolutely no regard to humanity and whatsoever. So, also during the trial, Gary made the statement that he had first stabbed his victims and later shifted tactics to strangling them because he said he got tired of getting blood on himself. Wow. To be able to even make a statement like that, you know, out loud to someone.
Right. Like, he's, like people are just things. He's more worried about himself getting dirty than it is about what he just did.
Exactly. So there was a case on July the 31st in Vermont where there was a fourth man that was attacked by Sampson, and his name was William Gregory. So minutes after Gregory pulled over in his 1989 maroon Chrysler convertible and let Sampson in, Gary shoved a knife in Greg's face. So after he had shoved the knife in Mr. Gregory's face, he ordered him to take a dirt road away from the highway. So Mr. Gregory said that the hitchhiker then told him that he planned to tie him to a tree and kill him and take his car. So Mr. Gregory escaped. He jumped out of the vehicle while the car was still in drive. Gary took off in the vehicle and he tried to chase him down. Actually fearing that he would get caught, Gary fled the scene in Mr. Gregory's car. Gary called the police and surrendered the next day after breaking into a ski chalet in Plymouth, Vermont. And he actually wound up setting off a burglar alarm. He knew he was in trouble. He knew he had been caught. He actually made another phone call for help. And I'm going to go ahead and play an audio tape for you now. And it's the 911 call that Gary made asking the police to come and arrest him for the murders that he had committed.
The unsuspecting officer.
This is about 911. Do you have an emergency?
Jurors also heard the 8-minute long 911 call from when Sampson turned himself in Vermont after a string of bank robberies, three murders, and a botched kidnapping.
I have a Mr. Sampson on the line who'd like to talk to somebody about
turning myself in, please, without getting killed.
Sampson seemed more concerned about his own safety on the recording, not telling the 911 operator and dispatcher about the murders until almost the end of the call.
Sampson, are you taking any medication?
No.
No medication?
Are you prescribed any medication?
No, because I've also killed a couple of people,
okay,
too.
Okay.
Okay. When did you kill someone?
I killed two people in Massachusetts and another one in New Hampshire the other day.
Sampson didn't express any remorse for what he had done, just that he wanted to stop.
I tried to kidnap a man today and take his car. And I didn't want to hurt him, and I almost did, and I'm sick of it. I know I'm going to go to waste the rest of my life, but it's better I'm in there than out here.
After Sampson's arrest, officers found two bags full of clothing and personal items belonging to his murder victims, as well as what's been described as his murder kit, complete with knives, tape, and cloth strips knotted together with wooden dowels, consistent with what had been used to tie up at least one victim.
Okay, next, we want to walk you through the trial. Now, Gary Sampson's trial took place in the U.S. District Court in Boston. On September 9th of 2003, Gary Sampson pleads guilty to the carjacking murders of McCloskey and Rizzo, both capital offenses under federal law.
After 6 weeks of jury selection, the testimony begins in the punishment phase of the trial. The only choices that were allowed are death by lethal injection and life in prison without parole.
So, witnesses then tell of casual encounters with Sampson in Marshfield, Bourne, and Plymouth in the days between the McCloskey and Rizzo murders.
In a taped interview with a Vermont state trooper, Sampson says his three victims would still be alive if the FBI agents had not bungled his attempt to turn himself in. Plymouth County jail officers testify that Sampson threatened to harm anyone who caused him problems in prison.
So, during the trial, a psychiatrist called upon by the prosecution would state that Gary did not suffer from any mitigating mental illness or impairment. He stated that Gary was intelligent, but violent and deeply antisocial, exhibiting signs of antisocial personality disorder.
We actually know from the Eileen Morneau's case that we discussed last week that those with anti-personality disorder or psychopathy tend to lie, they break the laws, they act impulsively, and they have a lack of regard for their own safety or even the safety of others. While the symptoms may lessen with age, other aspects of APD are deceitfulness, hostility, irresponsibility, manipulativeness, risk-taking behaviors, aggression, impulsivity, irritability, or lack of restraint. Their moods tend to be anger, boredom, or general discontent, which we clearly see 99% of the above when we discuss his history.
Yes.
So it is important to also note that there is a, generally there's a substance dependence or abuse at that time as well going on. So some type of drugs that they were involved in. We do know that he was involved with cocaine. So there is treatment for people with APD. It generally includes talk therapy and support, you know, for the affected family members. It's generally not something that just is there and it goes away. You know, symptoms can be managed by behavioral therapy and talk therapy.
So later during Gary's trial, the judge and jury would be told how Gary was physically and sexually assaulted multiple times while in prison. Now, they would discuss how he had been abused as a child, and that he was not mentally well. The defense said that the jury should consider his defects and not sentence him to death.
Now, I will tell you that in my research, that was a huge subject of anger with Gary, is when they wanted to talk about him being sexually assaulted in jail, in prison. He was adamant that, you know, he was embarrassed, even though there were documented cases where he had been sexually assaulted in prison, as well as being physically assaulted. And he was embarrassed by that.
He didn't want it to be known. As a man, I guess he probably thought it made him less of a man.
I guess. I'm not really sure. Of course, we know that he tried to kill the sheriff. You know, that even made reference to him being a possible transvestite. So that was horrible. When, you know, the defense did not want him to be sentenced to death. This was also a huge thing for them, because in Massachusetts, they did not have the death penalty after abolishing capital punishment in 1984. So Gary's sentence was actually the first of its kind since 1947. Federal law did change in 1994 to allow the U.S. Department of Justice to seek the death penalty when a murder is committed during a carjacking or kidnapping.
Now, defense witnesses portray Sampson as the product of learning disabilities, childhood abuse, and drug use. Now, mental health experts for the defense would continue to testify that although Sampson knew right from wrong, severe depression, alcohol and cocaine addiction, and brain dysfunction with wild mood swings prevented him from controlling his violent impulses.
There was actually a man who lived with the family, the Sampson family, in the early 1960s, and he actually testified that he never saw anyone abuse Sampson. But if we remember, his brother Wayne did tell, you know, that he was abused, and also his friends told about how he just seemed like the odd guy out, you know, when they were children.
Yeah.
So, turning the case over to the jurors, Judge Mark Wolf says they cannot sentence Sampson to death unless they're convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that he deserves that particular penalty. So on December the 23rd, Sampson is sentenced to death by lethal injection. After 10 hours of deliberation, a jury of 9 women and 3 men dismissed nearly every aspect of Sampson's defense. They say that Sampson should spend the rest of his life in prison without the possibility of parole for the stabbing of McCloskey and Rizzo. The defense would have 10 days following the sentencing to file an appeal. And of course, the appeal process is did start. So the judge actually, he told him, Jamie?
I believe he called Samson a man who had done monstrous things.
Gotcha. So, I mean, even the judge was, you know, in awe of what had happened. Yeah. You know, the violence that he had committed, you know. So, Judge Wolf actually goes on to sentence him to die by lethal injection. So, there were some developments in the case. I know I talked to you, or we talked to you earlier about the FBI dropping the phone call. There was a $10 million lawsuit filed by McCloskey's family over that mishandled call.
Now, on June the 1st, Samson pleads guilty in state court in New Hampshire to killing Robert Eli Whitney and receives the mandatory sentence of life without parole.
So he received the death penalty for the first two murders, and then he received life, sentence of life, for the last murder. So in September the 6th of 2005, the lawsuit that the McCloskey family had filed against the FBI, it was dismissed. So we don't know what wound up happening during that trial. It's not been disclosed. So it's private information. So May the 7th of 2007, a federal appeals court upholds the death sentence because these appeal processes have started. So on May the 11th, 2009, Samson's lawyer filed a motion for a new trial saying that a juror was, you know, that the jury was not adequately informed of his mental illness. I don't know how they could state that because they clearly, you know, had psychiatrists and psychologists to testify during that trial.
It was brought up during the trial.
Exactly. I don't know what more they would have wanted to have discussed. You know, that seems like that would have been enough.
But during the appeal process in 2011, the judge was notified that one of the jurors had lied during her screening process.
Is that something that's relevant? Like, does that happen?
Well, I think in this case, they thought it was relevant because she had withheld information that she had actually been a victim of domestic violence.
I see. Okay, so she basically was probably deemed not believable or not.
Just knowing that Samson had had a history of, you know, assault and threatening women, she may, you know, be a little biased against him.
Gotcha.
You know, from the start.
Gotcha. So Samson's death sentence was thrown out, and he was set to go for a second sentencing trial on September the 16th of 2015.
Now, during the second sentencing trial, Gary Samson was transferred to the United States Medical Center for Federal Prisoners for a mental health examination. Now, Gary would also have a brand new defense team from the first trial, and it was disclosed that six of the defense witnesses had died since the first trial.
Goodness gracious. Well, Gary would protest about the new defense team because, like I had talked to you about earlier, they wanted to discuss that he'd been sexually abused multiple times while in his early life and his adult life, and that actually impacted his ability to relate to others. Gary told his defense team that if they mentioned the sexual assaults, that he would hunt them down and kill them and their families. So there are actual recorded conversations from the jail to the attorneys that show proof that the threats were made. So the defense team would tell the judge of the mitigating circumstances, but the judge ordered that the trial must continue with the counsel that Gary had chosen. He was not about to allow there to be a third trial. So he ordered the defense to represent Gary to the extent that Gary would allow and that the law would allow. During the trial, the defense would actually call Gary's ex-wife, Karen Alexander, again to the stand to testify on his behalf, on Gary's behalf.
So she told that Gary had abandoned her just after their honeymoon and while she was pregnant with their son. He had never paid child support, yet one day he showed up out of the blue offering to trade her 10-year-old Mercury Sable with the car that he was driving, a sporty blue Volkswagen Jetta. Does that sound familiar to you?
Isn't that the car that the 19-year-old boy was driving?
Yes. We know that this car actually belonged to the 19-year-old college student who was lovingly referred to as Rizzo, and that was actually his second victim. So Gary told Karen that he wanted to trade the vehicles with her so that she wouldn't have to drive their 3-year-old son around in that old clunky vehicle. Now, Karen was the only witness that testified that if Sampson were executed, that it would have an emotional impact on her life.
She also told the jurors that there was a 28-year-old New Hampshire woman who suffers from spina bifida, had actually planned to testify on Gary's behalf. She apparently had some type of father-daughter relationship with Gary, but she decided against testifying. So as they were talking to Karen during the trial, she blurts out she doesn't want him to get the death penalty. So in response, the entire courtroom erupted with chaos. The families of the victims, the prosecution, the defense, everybody was standing up and was just outraged that she had said this. So the reason for that is you can't actually speak about that. You can't actually talk about how someone is going to be sentenced during the trial. That's actually up to the jury to decide. So the judge then says, you know, ignore that statement that you just made. You know, just throw that out. Don't, you know, even take that into consideration.
Yeah, because I'm relatively sure that both the Rizzo and the McCloskey families had said they had been ordered not to mention the death penalty in their testimony or risk a mistrial.
So they were furious. They were going to have to go through this again, you know. So I know that the victim's family actually said, our victim impact testimony was heavily edited and it had to be approved by the judge and the defense. And that was from Michael, which was the little Rizzo boy's father, who actually wanted Sampson executed for the murders. He said, now we have a sleazy circumvention of the rules. So Judge Mark Wolf ordered jurors to disregard Alexander's reference to the death penalty. Like I said, adding that nobody would be allowed to express an opinion on that, that it's exclusively up to the jurors.
So Alexander would go on to testify that she met Sampson in 1995 when they were attending Alcoholics Anonymous and described him as happy, personable, compassionate, and romantic. But after she married him in June of 97, he became explosive on their honeymoon, she testified.
She said that they had split up within weeks of the marriage when she found marijuana in his truck and told him he couldn't stay with her unless he got treatment because they had both just been involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, so you're not supposed to be on any type of substances. So while acknowledging that Sampson had never paid child support for their five-year-old Hunter, who is autistic and had rarely seen him, she said he's telephoned her to provide, you know, so he could provide emotional support to her and she could do the same for him. So
Alexander went on to say that she tried to get Sampson's mother, Charlotte, to testify on his behalf. But she cried and said it was not good for her health to talk about the case.
So outside the courtroom, Alexander said she plans to keep her son's surname as Sampson because she says, I fell in love with this man. You can't just erase what you had. I'm not embarrassed. I had a good relationship.
So now we're going to hear a little bit from the prosecution and the defense.
So the prosecution began with this statement. The defendant conforms his conduct when he wants to. He attacks on his own terms when it's to his advantage. These are the acts of a vicious predator, not a mentally ill person. And that was going to be the big debate here, guys, in this second trial was, what, you know, was he mentally ill or was he just a vicious predator? So the facts and the law in this case, they compel you to find that the defendant, Gary Lee Sampson, should be sentenced to death is what the prosecution would say.
But in his final appeal to jurors in Sampson's federal death penalty case, his defense lawyer, David Runke, said that Sampson was a sick man who would not harm anyone else if he is sentenced to life in prison rather than executed. Mr. Sampson is a mentally ill loser who will never hurt anybody again, Runke told jurors. And they had already heard 18 days of testimony. Sentenced him to life in prison. And in his final appeal to the jury, Runke cited testimony from defense witnesses that Sampson was diagnosed with dyslexia as a child, began drinking alcohol when he was 11, and was using drugs a short time later.
I want to tell you about some information that I found in the case, Jamie. When he was put back in prison again the second time, here in between these trials when he got moved, he actually, there's a video of him. He is in one of those jail cells where there's only an opening through the door that they can receive, like books or their meals or trays or things like that. You know, there's just that slight opening there.
Yeah.
He somehow had gotten his hands on a broomstick and actually wound up shaping it into like a shank. So
a homemade knife.
Yeah. And so as one of the commissary guards is actually coming to bring him his commissary, you can visibly see him shove this shank out through the door, that little opening in the door, and try to stab whoever is out there. Like, it doesn't matter to him who it is. You can clearly see him just jabbing, you know, trying to, you know, get somebody. But yet the defense is saying, you know, he's not going to hurt anybody again.
Right.
So clearly, there was definitely some misinformation.
The fact whether he's in prison or not, he's still going to try to hurt somebody. If he can get into contact with them.
Exactly.
Sounds like he still wants to hurt people anyway.
Exactly. So a neuropsychiatrist was called by the defense, and she diagnosed Samson as suffering from bipolar disorder and concluded that he knew right from wrong, but he was unable to stop himself from killing because of a significant mental impairment.
Now, a forensic psychiatrist called by the government testified that Samson wasn't bipolar but suffers from antisocial personality disorder, and he is able to control his conduct.
So we have completely two different, you know, viewpoints on this man, you know, here between the prosecution and the defense.
And
so,
both are supposed to be experts. Who do you believe?
Exactly. Well, that's the conflicting thing when you look at it from the forensic psychology standpoint of it, is because he does present some of these traits that would, you know, make it seem like he was a predator. Then there are some traits, if you want to look back to his childhood, you can, you know, you can go back so even as, even far as, excuse me, as even as far as 4 years old, you know, when he had the fall that caused, you know, the traumatic brain injury, that actually clearly alters, you know, the mind, the brain, and how it functions. So if you want to go all the way back, we can look for, you know, reasons that he's the way that he is. And so getting the two, you know, psychiatrists to decide on what's legitimate here is the big problem, you know,
right.
Especially in cases like these, there's not a clear agreement, you know, there's not a clear checklist that says, okay, if one person exhibits these factors, then they are mentally ill. You know, if another, in another checklist, okay, well, they're just a predator, you know, so we really have to dig deep in these type cases. We see that Gary has done all of these things up until, you know, while he was a child, young youth, you know, the robberies, the breaking and entering, all those type things, you know, and just as you had mentioned, he progresses. You know, his crimes just continue to get worse and worse and worse until it leads up to murder. Well, why did he murder people? Is it because, you know, he was ignored by the FBI? Is it because they didn't come and get him for the bank robberies? So he decided, I'll just advance a little bit further and I'll just kill people.
Right. Well, I would say, I'm not sure if this is 100% accurate, but if you're a child, and not saying that he's a child, but let's say you have the mentality of a child, when a child doesn't get their way or doesn't get attention, what's the first thing they do?
They act out.
They act out or they act up. They do something intentionally to get in trouble, because apparently any attention is good attention.
Yes, yeah. I mean, and that's evident, you know, in his life, you know. So, but his defense attorney, Mr. Runke, he also focused on Samson's call to the FBI, you know, to the Boston office the day before the killing spree. He offered to surrender on charges he faced for allegedly robbing those five banks in North Carolina, but the agents never showed up to arrest Samson, and it was later disclosed that an FBI clerk had disconnected the call. I will tell you, there is history available online if you want to actually search about the FBI clerk that did this. He was actually put on trial and actually wound up going to jail, prison, over this happening. Because he lied. There was actual proof that there were some lies that went on. You know, he stated he didn't know he had called, but clearly he later on admitted that he did. There was a lot of information, and we decided not to put it in this podcast. We can do a bonus episode later on this week If we have, you know, people that are interested in hearing more about it, we can tell you about that later on this week. So we'll give you that information, but just not in this podcast. So the government had actually countered that Sampson had ample opportunities to surrender to the authorities. He drove by several police stations, you know, on his way back home. During the course of the killings, he had plenty of time to turn himself in.
Runke, his defense, urged jurors to conclude that Sampson had accepted responsibility for his crimes because he did call 911 to surrender after breaking into the Vermont Ski Lodge on July 31st of 2001. He confessed to the murders, led police to Rizzo's body, and later pleaded guilty.
Yet, Gaziano told the jurors that Sampson's confession, offering gruesome details of his murder in a matter-of-fact tone, were evidence that he relished the killings and has no remorse. So that goes back to that whole, you know, argument of, is he mentally ill or is he a predator? You know, because it depends on how you look at it. So, in this case, after the defense rested, the prosecutors called a forensic psychiatrist, Dr. Michael Wellner, to rebut the defense's psychiatric statement. Wellner actually testified that Sampson is not bipolar, but suffers from antisocial personality disorder, so we know that's something everybody agreed on, alcohol dependence, and cocaine abuse. He told jurors that he had concluded that Sampson was not significantly impaired at the time of the murders, and he had no remorse about what he had done. I will tell you that during the first trial, he shed a tear, and that was it, during the sentencing. He didn't show any remorse or anything like that during the first trial. During the second trial, there was not even a tear. He was over it and done.
So, during cross-examination, Runke, the defense attorney, grilled Wellner about how much he charged the government for his services in the case. Now, Wellner did acknowledge that his fee for his session alone was $4,000. But what he actually billed the government was a lot higher than that.
$112,000 for 19 days of work on the Sampson case. So clearly, I am in the right career. So if you can spend just 19 days with someone and bill the government $112,000, there is something going on. So
That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. Now, are you ready for yet another twist in the story?
I don't know, but I'm going to say that I am.
Well, I'm going to tell you about this one. So during the second trial, there was a secret note that was passed by a juror, and it was placed into the sentencing packet. It was actually addressed to Gary Lee Sampson. So copies of the note were distributed to the defense team and the prosecution because the defense said that the letter potentially told of some juror misconduct, which would have resulted in yet another trial.
A third trial.
So the judge said that he had reviewed the note and decided that no other action was required. So again, fireworks flew in the jury room when the letter was found because initially no one would confess that they wrote it. So being threatened that they would have to start all over again because of the potential misconduct, a male juror, finally confessed. So a man from the jury said that he had written the note for the judge to see. He wanted to ask the judge, does carjacking warrant a death sentence? Well, clearly, the judge had told them in the beginning of the trial, before the trial even began, this is what warrants a death sentence. And so we do know that a death sentence, that a carjacking or a kidnapping would have to be involved. So we don't know what the juror was trying to do. You know, it was not a good thing.
If he meant for the judge to see it, why address it to Gary Lee Sampson?
Right. Well, the thing about it was the juror never even told anybody. He put it in the packet. The foreman, the female foreman, actually found the note while she was, you know, closing up the packet and making sure that all the I's were dotted and the T's were crossed. She just had that personality type. And so she flipped out. Like, she knew that there was fixing to be, you know, a meltdown on everybody's end. So the female juror foreman, she would later say, none of us looked at it. None of us wanted to look at it. none of us wanted to know what was in that letter, because in that instance, we felt like if we knew, then it was ours. We didn't want to own it. We didn't want to touch it. And she was like, oh my God, why is that here? You know, why is this happening right now in this moment? You know, she was just in shock. So, just like you said earlier, you know, why didn't the juror send the message to the judge, you know, with a stamp on it or something? You know, why didn't he take the opportunity to speak to the judge in person? And no one knew, you know, so what mattered now was for the 7 men and 5 women, including the juror who wrote the letter, to reach the next verdict. What to do?
So, after 7 weeks of testimonies, it took the jury 3 days to determine the verdict. So, Gary Lee Sampson was sentenced to death again on January the 9th of 2017.
I'm going to play a clip for you guys, and it is the audio of the family of the victims.
Today, for the 2nd time in his life, convicted murderer Gary Sampson was sentenced to death. His victims' families relieved.
And although it's a good day, we're not going to be out celebrating like we won the World Series. It's a very sobering and somber day for us.
Mike and Mary Rizzo's son, Jonathan, was only 19 years old when Sampson tied him to a tree and stabbed him multiple times. It was a gruesome and cruel crime that the jury found worthy of a death sentence. But it was a split jury that decided on the sentence of life in prison for Sampson's murder of Philip McCloskey. The 69-year-old was Sampson's first victim the week he went on a carjack killing spree in July of 2001. His son, Scott McCloskey, says he's looking forward to closure.
This isn't about competition or anything. It all ended up in the verdict of death, so I'm happy with the results.
Sampson admitted to carjacking and murdering Rizzo and McCloskey in Massachusetts. Days later, he also admitted to strangling Robert Eli Whitney in New Hampshire in Meredith. He was sentenced to die for his crimes in 2003, but that sentence was overturned due to juror misconduct. Today, the family's now breathing a sigh of relief, grateful this horrible chapter of their lives is finally over.
Philip, Eli, and Jonathan all are in my heart and in my pictures in my wallet every single day. This has been brutal. I am so glad it's over.
And Massachusetts.
So now that you guys have had an opportunity to hear from the family of the victims, and, you know, we've heard about this case and how, you know, this man could have potentially had 3 different trials for the same thing because, number one, a juror lied about their history. 2, someone stuck a note in a packet for a judge that could have caused a mistrial as well. A woman blurts out on the stand that she doesn't want him to receive the death penalty. There are so many things that actually go into determining that a person was actually treated properly, that they received the sentence that they, you know,
should have gotten.
So there's so many things that actually go into it. We wanted you all to just see how just simple little errors could actually cause something like this to happen, and potentially even, you know, no, he would have probably not gotten out of jail, but he would have been sentenced to life in prison. But that potential was there. You know, there was some type of potential there. But as of now, as of August the 20th of the year 2020, Gary Lee Sampson still sits on death row awaiting his execution in Terre Haute, Indiana. I hope you guys have enjoyed this episode as much as we have telling you about it.
Yeah, it's always like hard when we review these cases of what they did and what the victims suffered, but people need to know. I mean, these are the people that walk out amongst us every day, and the only difference between the people that are in jail and the people that aren't is the people that aren't haven't been caught yet. So keep your eyes open.
Exactly. We have to be aware of the people that surround us. So until next time, I look forward to our bonus episode that'll happen later this week where we tell you about the FBI clerk that actually wound up going to prison for his error in this course of events here. So dropping a phone call is actually led to his life in prison. So I look forward to seeing you guys next time or talking to you more. Bye.
Bye, guys.